Hello and welcome to the Learning College. My name is Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. Later links posted on pyville.net and also my own kirksvilletoday.com. We're going to try something new today in two ways. We're going to do a deep reading of a piece, one we've actually done before, and I'm also recording on new equipment, which might be irrelevant. Hopefully it's a slight improvement. It's zoom.us, which became very popular in the U.S. during the great fake crisis over the cold virus in the opening months of 2020. People started using zoom.us to do group video conferences, and you can also do audio conferences, and you can simply record yourself as I'm doing here. Anyway, what we're going to look at for the deep read, as I'm calling this, is a story we've already done out of Saki called A Holiday Task, and we're going to consider more deeply the author's meanings and intentions in a sort of English literary class type of way, to the best extent of my ability. And I'm not I've often thought I should have majored in English if I was to get more value out of my college years than certainly international politics or international relations was my actual major, but that's reading a bunch of Marxist pap. At least if you major in English, you get a good amount of high-quality literature, even if you do also get the standard leftist interpretations. So hopefully I can do this right, and I have pre-tried. A Holiday Task, Hector Human Row, The Complete Stories of Saki, A Holiday Task. Well, just this is only, you know, his average story. About 3.5 pages, a very dense text, but not overly long. And we will look at every little element that occurs to us to try to figure out what the author is communicating. A Holiday Task. Ken Elm Jurton entered the dining hall of the Golden Galleon Hotel in the full crush of the luncheon hour. And I will tell you every little thing I notice. You see if you can notice things I don't notice. And you can respond to me at pyville.net if you like. Sue and I had already talked about this to an extent, and we'll get into that here. Anyway, the first thing you notice is the very odd name, and we know that this is what he generally does. Names that sound like honest, earnest, average English names, but they're always twisted, like Ken Elm. It's kind of odd, and Elm is a stately sort of tree. It doesn't throw a lot of stuff off of it the way that maples do. Ken Elm, that is not a name I've heard anyone sound. Nowadays, we would think that's a black name, but that's certainly not what he's implying there. Jurton, very odd name. You know, it's like you think it sounds sort of like Barton, which is a very common name, but it's Jurton, which sounds like jerk or hesitation or some kind of ungainly movement. And we're going to see that sort of echoed in that he's socially shy, awkward, the usual type. Anyway, so Ken Elm, one word, Jurton, enters the dining hall of the Golden Galleon Hotel in the full crush of the luncheon hour. Nearly every seat was occupied, and small additional tables had been brought in where the floor space permitted to accommodate latecomers, with the result that many of the tables were almost touching each other. You know how I've seen this in New York and maybe other places where there's limited room. And even if you're not with another party, you may have to sit next to them as though you were. So it kind of sounds like that. There's a forced proximity, if not interaction. It certainly facilitates eased interaction due to the crush, as he says. Many of the tables were almost touching each other. Jurton, J-E-R-T-O-N, was beckoned by a waiter to the only vacant table that was discernible, and took his seat with the uncomfortable and wholly groundless idea that everyone in the room was staring at him. So he's walking through a crowded room full of lunch diners who, of course, are worried about their food and their conversations. But like shy people, he thinks the focus is on him. And that's why people would say that shyness is a form of egotism. When it's excessive, I mean, to an extent it's natural and probably a little even more natural in Northern European types than are as expansive and outgoing as Mediterranean types. But when it's more than that, when it doesn't burn off, like the overcast in the Southern California morning, then it's actually a sort of inverted form of egotism. The very idea that they're all paying attention to you, as he's saying, it's not accurate, but that's how it feels. But that's got to be overcome by this realization reflected in your behavior and eventually in your mind when it becomes a habit not to think the way that you initially feel, because it's groundless. And he says that the groundless idea that everyone in the room was staring at him. No, most people don't care about your problems. You've heard that saying, which is puts you in correct perspective. 80% of the people don't care about your problems. The other 20% are glad you have them. Is that cynical or just real? He was a youngish man of, and yeah, that's the thing. People aren't thinking about you. They're thinking about their agenda and what's on their mind. Very few are able to escape that ego cloud. So that, as I've mentioned many times, one of the characteristics of proles or the lower class, the working class, is that they will often start talking to you about people they should, and an upper middle class person would realize that you don't know and explain to you who they're talking about. They will just start talking to you in media res, which is a Greek term they use in English class. We're in the middle of things as though you are familiar with their personal cast of characters, like you are just another addition to the cloud of people in their head. So the ability to get out of yourself, which is what education literally means, the higher you have to go higher up the social and intellectual scale to see that in action. Everything is kind of mushed all together in the lower level. Anyway, he was a youngish man of ordinary appearance, quiet of dress, and unobtrusive of manner. Well, they must have been different back in those days, huh? And he could never wholly rid himself of the idea that a fierce light of public scrutiny beat on him as though he had been a notability or a super nut. So, as I said, it's inverted self-importance, inverted egoism when it's not overcome. Because it is somewhat natural, but you could say all egotism or egoism is natural too, but it has to be overcome by the rational use of the mind to place oneself as everything else in correct perspective. After he had ordered his lunch, again, so he's drawn to the one open spot in the whole place, thinks everybody's looking at him, sits down, orders. After he had ordered his lunch, there came the unavoidable interval of waiting with nothing to do but stare at the flower vase on his table and to be stared at in his imagination by several flappers. And as I think I said the first time, so flappers were around. I think this story would have been written probably 1915, but maybe before 1920. We always associate flappers with the 1920s. In the high economic times before the crash, but there were evidently flappers even earlier than that, and not just in the U.S. I guess I'd always kind of thought flappers was a U.S. phenomenon, but there were flappers in England. So in his imagination, these flappers, a young girl kind of dressed provocatively, the low-waisted dress, the headband, that type of thing is what we associate that style with. But he imagines not only that everyone's looking at him, but all the women are looking at him in particular. Some mature beings of the same sex, other people he imagines looking at him, and a satirical-looking Jew, wry or hook-nosed face, Doug Gottlieb, Anthony Weiner is what he means by a satirical-looking Jew, like he's making fun of stuff or mocking it. So he imagines not only all people generally are looking at him, but all these specific subtypes. The women are looking at him, the young women, the old women, a Jew. In order to carry off the situation with some appearance of unconcern, he became spuriously interested in the contents of the flower vase. Again, that's of interest for the use of spuriously. It's seldom used in that way. This means fake. Usually, almost always, people only use words in conventional ways, and that's actually one of the reasons you read literature. If you're smart and you're artistic yourself, you're trying to write better, to learn subtler psychology and to learn subtler word use. So here's a use of spurious, and you can remember that one. You don't only have to use spurious with argument. You can use it spurious interest, right? So you learn new ways to use. Well, it's not just the vocabulary. It's much more knowing how and when to use it. And part of that is creating new uses in order to reflect, put better, tighter skins or more attractive skins on reality. It's like if you're making a little bit of language like using a glove and you're trying to get the best possible grip on something. Well, sometimes you have to use a new word. You have to make it up. And I think as a writer, that's part of your duty, because the reality is constantly changing. Now, there are permanent themes related to human nature or whatever human species you're considering's nature. But there's always new things and there's always old things, and combining them and articulating them as perfectly and artistically as you can is what a writer is trying to do. If he's a serious writer, that's what serious writing means. Okay. And it's not really something you would even consciously attempt. It's something that would inform everything that you did automatically, because otherwise, you know, why would you be writing at all? Either just to convey pure information for money or purely to entertain without trying to elevate or incise. Anyway, so what is the name of those roses, do you know? I now, here for me, I don't know in the world how to intone that. So he's spuriously pretending to be interested in the contents of the flower vase because he has no one to talk to, so he's a little embarrassed dining alone. Even amid the rush, he feels, you know, they say you never feel more alone than in a crowd. And so he's still self-conscious, and he's trying to pass it off as being interested in the flowers at the table. What is the name of those roses, do you know? He asked the waiter. The waiter was ready at all times to conceal his ignorance concerning items of the wine list or menu. So the waiter is prepared for conventional avenues of attack, even though it's kind of his job to know all the items. He was frankly ignorant as to the specific name of the roses. He's not worried about that because it doesn't reflect on him, he thinks. Amy Sylvester Partington, said a voice at Jerton's elbow. So, someone willing to be Mr. Helper, Sam Kinison said. Somebody wants to play Mr. Helper, he said to Rodney Dangerfield and back to school. Maybe you can tell me why we failed to achieve victory. One of the best movie scenes ever. Anyway, so she hops in and there's some rose named Amy Sylvester Partington. Said a voice at Jerton's elbow. Again, Jerton is his last name. The voice came from a pleasant-faced, well-dressed young woman. I was thinking she was more older, but she's a young woman, who was sitting at a table that almost touched Jerton's. He thanked her hurriedly and nervously for the information and made some inconsequent remark about the flowers. Now notice, we're two paragraphs in. The story begins with Jerton, and my argument is that it's primarily concerned with him as an example of the category of shy person or shy man. And that's the basic frame of the story, because that's where we come into it from. or the alternative view would be, the shy man is leading us into the real story, which is about the odd behavior of this woman. And we know, and we'll get into how Saki treats women generally. He sees them as schemers, and typically they're after money or they're after status. And they're very much not above doing underhanded, devious things to achieve their ends. Will this be another of that type of character? So he says she's pleasant faced, she's young, she's sitting near Jerton. She obviously, you can bet your bottom dollar, notices that he is A, alone, B, very shy and nervous. So she's thinking, oh, well, here's something I can work with. She might even be interested in him some way. We might think like sexually or romantically, but we don't know if Durden has money or is good looking. So he's probably, it sounds like he and she are about the same age, roughly, is what I'm thinking. But I might be wrong. He didn't say anything about Ken Elm Durden's way or age so far. So that's my unconscious assumption I'm making consciously articulated. So she fills in the information. And she says then, "It is a curious thing," said the young woman, "that I should be able to tell you the name of those roses without an effort of memory, because if you were to ask me my name, I should be utterly unable to give it to you." This is a gambit. A gambit is like a chess opening that's aimed at a particular result. And if you're not familiar with it, then and you don't know where it's headed by the movement, you're very likely to be defeated. But it's kind of cheap in a lot of ways. I used to use one when I was in chess as a mediocre player, but I had one opening that I knew very well. And if people were not familiar with the right way to respond, they would quickly find me on their throat. Now, that's how inferior or mediocre players do it. The better ones are much more skilled at playing in more conventional openings that, because they know they will get their chances down the line. But this is a gambit. She knows exactly what she's doing. And so it's similar to what's in the... I just paused there. I rarely refer to technical stuff because it doesn't matter. The key is the contents, but just pause and restart to make sure that works. It is a very, very simple recording. And I always try to do this just as part of Team White and part of the Learning College. You can record yourself and multiple people. Anyway, using zoom.us, just create a meeting for yourself as the only person there. Record it, stop, and then when you stop, you end the meeting finally, and then it pulls it in the form, its natural native form is MP4, I believe. So enough of that. Anyway, so I'm saying this is an opening gambit. A gambit is not just in chess, but it could be it's a conversational gambit, except we pretty much can guess that she has some deeper motive in introducing this information when she doesn't know him. And we suspect, because we are familiar with not just his other female characters, but his other male characters, namely Cyprian, Clovis, and the teenage girl Vera, that they're always up to some kind of trick. So we suspect this is another in that line of characters. We also know that he's written multiple stories that concern men meeting in a park, like on a bench, and trying to fool or trick each other, or not. So this is very similar, even though instead of being alone in a park at dusk, we're now in the middle of the day in a crowded room, but it's still the same thing. Two people who don't know each other thrown together in very close talking distance. So we'll see what this woman is up to. But we definitely, knowing Saki, we suspect she's up to something. At the least, she's bored and wants to chat about herself, but more likely she has some greater object in mind. So, curious thing I could tell you about the roses, but I don't know my own name, she's saying. That's her opening gambit to see how if he is interested, how is he going to respond? Is he just going to nod and say, oh, how are you not going to respond to someone who says they don't know their own name? You're almost forced to respond to that, and that, as Saki's about to say. But notice, again, Durden is shy. Durden had not harbored the least intention of extending his thirst for name labels to his neighbor. He ain't looking to pick any broad up, or let alone even a modest chat. After her rather remarkable announcement, however, he was obliged to say something in the way of polite inquiry. Yeah, you could hardly let that remark pass. You don't know your own name. Plus, he's waiting for his food, so what the heck? Most people would find that kind of interesting, while being a little suspicious, or I would anyway. Yes, answered the lady. I suppose it is a case of partial loss of memory. Partial loss of memory. I was in the train. She's giving her own backstory and exposition here. Like they say in bad movie writing, you know, the characters will, hey, you know, one will set the other up to say crap that ought to be more cleverly worked in there, instead of just writing out what the backstory of each character is and how they got to the current circumstances. Anyway, she's going to give her own backstory. I was in the train coming down here. My ticket told me that I had come from Victoria and was bound for this place. We don't know what town it is, just the name of the hotel, Golden Galleon Hotel. I had a couple of 5-pound notes and a sovereign on me, no visiting cards or any other means of identification, and no idea as to who I am. Now, to me, that sounds, upon rereading this, that sounds extremely unlikely. Who goes around with no kind of identification on them at all? Most people would have 20 kinds. Even without a driver's license, they'd have 20 things with their name on it. I can only hazily recollect that I have a title. I am Lady Somebody. Beyond that, my mind is blank. Now, right there, you know, rereading this, that's completely, completely implausible. So if she didn't remember her name, how the hell is she remembering that she's a lady? So that right there is telling you that, yes, as Sue suggested to me, she is scamming completely knowingly from the outset. Hadn't you any luggage with you? Asked Jerton. That is what I didn't know. I knew the name of this hotel and made up my mind to come here. And when the hotel porter who meets the trains asked if I had any luggage, I had to invent a dressing bag and a dress basket. I could always pretend that they had gone astray. And she's telling this to a complete stranger. I gave him the name of Smith, and presently he emerged from a confused pile of luggage and passengers with a dressing bag and dress basket labeled Kestrel-Smith. I had to take them. I don't see what else I could have done. Interesting that there would be hyphenated names even back then in the UK. And what she could have done is not lie about her name, not pretend. So she's telling all this, admitting an act of overt criminality to someone she doesn't know. Why? Well, she has designs. And how would she remember that she's a lady but not remember her own name? That seems extremely unlikely. Jerton said nothing, but he rather wondered what the lawful owner of the baggage would do. Natural enough. Notice he's being quiet as she's saying this. But you're going to suspect she needs, as most women, very little incentive to keep talking. Of course, it was dreadful arriving at a strange hotel with the name of Kestrel Smith. But it would have been worse to have arrived without luggage. Anyhow, I hate causing trouble. Yeah, she hates causing trouble like a snake hates going into a hole in the ground. I mean, she's telling this to someone she doesn't know. And so she has no trouble involving others in her own affairs. She's dragged him into it. He has nothing to do with it. She dragged the Kestrel Smiths into it in a quite inconvenient way. She has no money to pay for her lunch, as we're going to find out. So, yeah, she has no trouble at all saying one thing and meaning something else. She does not hate causing trouble. She enjoys causing trouble, like so many of his female characters, and no few of his male characters either. I mean, Clovis does nothing but cause trouble that amuses him. Mischief. Jerton had visions of harassed railway officials and distraught Kestrel Smiths, but he made no attempt to clothe his mental picture in words, so he doesn't have the courage to really contradict her and say, oh, well, don't have any problem committing crimes and messing up things for the police and the train officials and the Kestrel Smiths and talking to me when I didn't say anything to you. Yeah, causing trouble is not something that bothers you or that you hate, as you say. The lady continued her story because she knows who she's dealing with. She knows she's brazen and he's unbold, to say the least. Naturally, none of my keys would fit the things, but I told an intelligent page boy that I had lost my key ring and he had the locks forced in a twinkling. So further criminality and further lying. Rather too intelligent, that boy. He will probably end up in Dartmoor, which is a jail, G-A-O-L, a prison. The Kestrel Smith toilet tools aren't up to much, so she has no problem using the stuff in her acquired stolen luggage. and is actually critical of the stuff she stole and its quality. But they are better than nothing. If you feel sure that you have a title, said Jordan, why not get a hold of a peerage and go right through it? Peerage would be a book of like who's who among the nobility, and there's various books. Almanac de Gotha, does he mention that in here? But that's a peerage and a list of titles. So he's being a typical male. He's being helpful. He's giving her a solution to problems that she's posing, even though they're not actually problems. They're part of an amusing game for her. Yes, I'm buying that interpretation. And she is manipulating him, and he is dealing with what she says rather than what she means, which is always dangerous. Because now you're in their game and they're running things. He could say, look, Missy, I'm not going to be part of any of your criminal scamming activity. However, she's maybe good looking or whatever. Who knows? Maybe he wants to play along. And, you know how men and women are. You know, if they're both single and unattached, he might be looking in that regard. So you're always alert for that in the text, or that's one thing you're ready to read in the minute you see it in the text. Of course, this is 100 years ago and people are a little less forward about such things, but that's always on the table as far as motives and intentions. But when he's dealing with what she says rather than what she means, he's now become a tool in her game, although he may be playing along for while withholding his actual knowledge of what she's up to. We don't know quite yet. But, you know, if someone is shy and they don't go out in public, then they're socially awkward, then they might also be a little bit naive, maybe. So he says, if you feel sure that you've got a title, why not get a hold of a peerage and go right through it? Oh, I tried that. I skimmed through the list of the House of Lords and Whitaker, but a mere printed string of names conveys awfully little to one, you know. If you were an army officer that had lost your identity, you might pore over the army list for months without finding out who you were. I'm going on another tack. I'm trying to find out by various little tests who I am not. That will narrow the range of uncertainty down a bit. You may have noticed, for instance, that I'm lunching principally off Lobster Newburgh. I don't even know what I've heard of it, but I don't really know what it is. Is that the lobster? No, that's a lobster roll where it's all munched up with maybe macaroni and mayonnaise and put on a roll. I don't know what Lobster Newburgh is. I have a vague idea of a sort of salad. Anything about lobster that's not just cracking the tail and putting it in melted butter is the same to me. But again, I'm not, you know, I don't know everything. I don't think I've ever, no, I know for a fact I've never had Lobster Newburgh in my life. I should pause and look it up, but I'm betting that many of you listening know what it is, and in any case, you can easily look it up yourself. All education is self-education. That's my excuse whenever I don't know something. Jerton had not ventured to notice anything of the sort. He had not ventured to, he's not noticing that she's eating Lobster Newburgh, and we'll start to see, we're starting to wonder if this is her excuse to run down other women that she knows, which of course women love doing that. One thing, the nature of women is revealed in many ways, but one thing is if there are some really good looking women and there's other women and there's other women around, and if a male insults that, say, the best looking woman, a lot of the other women who will absolutely love that, because all women are at war to try to find a few good men, because the natural biological way of the things work is that women prefer the top 1 to 2 out of 10 men. So the natural form, and they don't mind sharing them because they'd rather have that than the 80% they don't like because they consider them inferior. That's how biology has set things up. So they're all in the same game because there's comparatively few men who are at the top of the list that might actually be desirable to almost all women. And so the women have to go after that man, and that puts them naturally at odds, whereas all men are just trying to get whatever women they can biologically if they didn't face any other compulsions of law, of conscience, or merely of habit. That's how they would act. So when we know that psychology and that biology, that informs our reading of the literature and to see, oh, is this woman about to start running down other women out of her own amusement while also feigning that she doesn't remember her own name, but she does remember her own title. That's like the clothes make the man, the status makes the woman. And the status of the man interests the woman. And she will feign to be interested in other things, but the money and status are generally what's driving them. Anytime a woman, particularly in right-wing politics, approaches you, it's usually personal. Something I've noticed over 20 years. And plenty of women are smart enough to pretend that they are truly interested in politics or whatever else the man is doing. But it's, and I'm saying apart from, it has nothing to do with politics or any specific politics, or it's in anything in life. The women are billed, as Schopenhauer would say, their whole object, Schopenhauer said this, men attain direct mastery over the world by understanding things and learning about them and dominating them. But women are built to manipulate men to achieve what they want, from sperm to produce babies up to any material goods they want. So understand all that. So how is this woman going to use him? By, she's bored, she's telling him her story, and she may have some other object in mind. We'll have to see. And we'll have to see if she's about to start running down some other women, which women love to do. You may have noticed, for instance, that I'm lunching principally off Lobster Newberg. Jurton had not ventured to notice anything of this sort. It's an extravagance because it's one of the most expensive dishes on the menu, but at any rate, it proves that I'm not Lady Starping. She never touches shellfish, and poor Lady Brattleshrub has no digestion at all. If I am her, I shall certainly die in agony in the course of the afternoon, and the duty of finding out who I am will devolve on the press and the police and those sort of people. So now, how implausible is it that she doesn't remember her own name, but she remembers all these other women? I think that's extremely, on second reading, I say that is impossible, absurd even. And I should have picked up on it, but I didn't. I shall be, so finding out who she is will devolve on the press and the police and those sort of people. I shall be past caring. She'll be dead from reaction to shellfish. Lady Newford doesn't know one rose from another, and she hates men, so she wouldn't have spoken to you in any case. And Lady Mousehilton flirts with every man she meets. I haven't flirted with you, have I? Jurton hastily gave the required assurance. Oh, no. Well, you see, continued the lady, that knocks four off the list at once. It'll be rather a lengthy process bringing the list down to one, said Jurton. Oh, but of course there are heaps of them that I couldn't possibly be. Women who've got grandchildren or sons old enough to have celebrated their coming of age. I've only got to consider the ones about my own age. I tell you how you might help me this afternoon. Oh, here we go. If you don't mind, go through any of the back numbers of Country Life magazine and those sorts of papers that you can find in the smoking room and see if you come across my portrait with an infant son or anything of that sort. Now she's totally pulling his leg. She has a kid and she's forgotten him. It won't take you 10 minutes. I'll meet you in the lounge about tea time. Thanks awfully. And the fair unknown, capital F-U, having graciously pressed Jurton into the service for her lost identity, rose and left the room. As she passed the young man's table, she halted for a moment and whispered, "Did you notice that I tipped the waiter a shilling? We can cross Lady Ulwhite off the list. She would have rather died than do that." Aspersing the character of another woman. At 5 o'clock, Jurton made his way to the hotel lounge. He had spent a diligent but fruitless quarter of an hour among the illustrated weeklies in the smoking room. His new acquaintance was seated at a small tea table with a waiter hovering in attendance. "China tea or Indian?" she asked as Jurton came up. "China, please, and nothing to eat. Have you discovered anything?" So he continues to play along dutifully with this fraudulent woman. "Only negative information. I'm not Lady Befnal. She disapproves dreadfully at any form of gambling, so when I recognized a well-known bookmaker in the hotel lobby, I went and put a tenner on an unnamed filly by William III out of Mitrovica for the 3:15 race, so betting on horses. I suppose the fact of the animal being nameless was what attracted me. Did it win? Asked Turton. No, it came in fourth, the most irritating thing a horse can do when you've hacked it to win or place. Anyhow, when you've hacked it, win or place, not to win or place. Anyhow, I know now that I'm not Lady Befnal. It seems to me that the knowledge was rather dearly bought, commented Jordan. Well, yes, it rather cleaned me out, admitted the identity seeker. A florin is about all I've got left on me. The lobster Newberg made my lunch rather an expensive one, and of course I had to tip that boy for what he did to the Kestrel Smithlocks. I've got rather a useful idea, though. I feel certain that I belong to the Pivot Club. I'll go back to town and ask the hall porter there if there are any letters for me. He knows all the members by sight, and if there are any letters or telephone messages waiting for me, of course that will solve the problem. If he says there aren't any, I shall say, you know who I am, don't you? So I'll find out anyway. The plan seemed a sound one. A difficulty in its execution suggested itself to Jert. Of course, said the lady when he hinted at the obstacle. There's my fare back to town and my bill here and cabs and things. If you lend me £3, that ought to see me through comfortably. Again, this is reminiscent of the stories about the men on the park bench, bums and beggars with stories and trying to outduel each other. But the shy boy is not going to outduel this woman, who's quite brazen. Thanks ever so. Then there's the question of that luggage. I don't want to be saddled with that for the rest of my life. So she's already got £3 off him, and he's going to get him to guard her stolen bags while she gallivants off to carry on some other charade. I don't want to be saddled with that other baggage for the rest of my life. I'll have it brought down to the hall, and you can pretend to mount guard over it while I'm writing a letter. Then I shall just slip away to the station, and you can wander off to the smoking room, and they can do what they like with the things. They'll advertise themselves after a bit, and the owner can claim them. Jerton acquiesced in the maneuver, as he's acquiesced all along, and duly mounted guard over the luggage while its temporary owner slipped unobtrusively out of the hotel with his £3. Her departure was not, however, altogether unnoticed. Two gentlemen were strolling past Jerton, and one of them remarked to the other, "Did you see the tall young woman in gray who went out just now? She is the lady." His promenade, or his walking, carried him out of earshot at the critical moment when he was about to disclose the elusive identity. The lady who? Jerton could scarcely run after a total stranger, break into his conversation, and ask him for information concerning a chance passerby. Besides, it was desirable that he should keep up the appearance of looking after the luggage. In a minute or two, however, the important personage, the man who knew, came strolling back alone. Jerton summoned up all his courage and waylaid him. So there you go. He's very socially, like, not super willing to interact. He's the exact opposite of her. He can barely talk to people, and she easily scams them. I think I heard you say you knew the lady who went out of the hotel a few minutes ago, a tall lady, dressed in gray. Excuse me for asking if you could tell me her name. I've been talking to her for a half an hour. She knows all my people and seems to know me, so I suppose I've met her somewhere before, but I'm blessed if I could put a name to her, could you? Certainly, she's a Mrs. Stroop. S-T-R-O-O-P. Mrs.? Queried Jerton. Yes, she's the lady champion at golf in my part of the world. I kept thinking tennis. Yes, she's the lady champion at golf in my part of the world, an awful good sort, and goes about a good deal in society, but she has an awkward habit of losing her memory every now and then and gets into all sorts of fixes. She's furious, too, if you make any allusion to it afterwards. Good day, sir. The stranger passed on his way, and before Jerton had time to assimilate his information, he found his whole attention centered on an angry-looking lady who was making loud and fretful-seeming inquiries of the hotel clerks. "Has any luggage been brought here from the station by mistake? A dress basket and dressing case with the name Kestrel Smith? It can't be traced anywhere. I saw it put in at Victoria, that I'll swear. Why, there's my luggage. The locks have been tampered with. Jordan heard no more. He fled down to the Turkish bath and stayed there for hours. Now, that's the end of the story. I just don't know what to make of it other than his conception of the interchange and interaction between a very shy man and a very brazen woman. And yet she's pleasant-faced, she's young, she's a golf champion. Cop says she's, or whoever this fellow was that he talked to, says she's done it before. I've given you all I can to make heads or tails of it, but on reviewing it, I do think that she was scamming him for her own amusement. I don't see her information. I've never heard of anyone's memory just turning on and off like that. So I have to think it's likely or it's a scam. And we know from the entire oeuvre, O-E-U-V-R-E, that is the collected works of Saki, that it is loaded. It is the rare story in which there's not someone who's up to a market deception of others. So that must be the pounding of the gavel and the final conclusion. But it's not 100%, but I'd say it's about 90%. Anyway, thanks for being with me today on this first deep read as part of The Learning College. I've been Alex Linder, and you can find everything we record at vnn.forum or vnnforum.com, and I'll be back with you again for more from Hector Hugh Munro and the complete stories of Saki real soon.